There's always something new from our sponsor, Text Control. They just released version 30 of their document processing library that includes new document collaboration features. Using TX Text Control, you can integrate online document editing, document signing, collaboration, and PDF processing into your ASP.NET and ASP.NET Core web applications. Whether you need to create PDF invoices, quotations, or reports, TX Text Control provides the developer libraries for all document-related tasks. Check out the new features and see their technologies in action by visiting the live demo at demos.textcontrol.com. That's demos.textcontrol.com. Hi, I'm Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Today I'm talking with Alex Falcone. His debut album, Vanilla, just dropped. You can check him out at alexfalcone.ninja. He's also the host, one of the hosts of the Read and Weep podcast. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great. Not a musician. It definitely sounded like a musician the way you said that.
It did. When an album drops, it sounds pretty amazing. So it does. I thought about my opening. I'm trying to figure out the opening, and I've got a bunch of them, and they're all bad. So somebody told me once, I was with my boss, and we're at a conference, and the guy says, "Yeah, you know, I'm a comedian." And my boss, without missing a beat, was like, "Oh, what restaurant do you work at?" It was so mean.
So harsh.
Here's the question: on the spectrum, on the slider bar from Kevin Hart to me, who worked once at Barbati's Pan and was given a $5 tip after after an open mic, where do you sit in the comedy spectrum?
I mean, I don't have a real job, so that which puts me in the upper, I don't know, 1% probably, like very upper echelon. But it was a weird journey here, and I definitely don't. It's not like I'm just crushing comedy so hard I don't need to work. It's that I've just had enough side hustles over the years that it hasn't had to coalesce into a full time gig. But yeah, I'm making a living doing the stupidest things, so that puts me in a very elite tier.
And your wife still continues to hang out with you?
She does. Well, she has a real job. That's another thing. I have a built-in safety net that we have health insurance, including dental and vision, through her. So she's in the other room having much more important meetings than me.
So that was the next question. Where does healthcare come from when you're a comedian, right?
I would highly recommend marrying somebody motivated and functional in a normal society.
So have you ever, you've had a job before, right?
I haven't really ever had a job, no. I mean, that's stupid to say also, but I had a very strange thing happen to me out of college where I was like, I like did some freelance web design stuff out of college. And then right when I graduated was when Facebook launched their API, and I made a little app for a guy off Craigslist for like $20 that took off. He like brought me as a partner and we sold that company, and I was able to waste a year doing improv instead of working. And then I've been able to like cobble stuff together since then. So just like little hustles, putting it together.
Uh-huh. And when you say you're in the top like echelon, people need to understand what a long tail that comedy is, right?
Like, yeah. And also that's not quantitative. That's not, or qualitative. That is quantitative. I'm like, I'm probably in the 1% that I don't have to work at a restaurant, but I am not because of skill by any stretch am I putting me there. But yeah, there's very few people who get to do this for a living. And then it's a very long tail of people who are going out and making art in the evenings for no money, but also no recognition, not even a little bit of positive feedback, just because they have to go talk to people in a bar every night.
Okay. So I want to understand the journey. So I'm imagining it in the context of myself. So let's say that in a parallel Loki variant universe, I continued doing the open mic at Barbati's Pan. And does someone pull you aside and go, "Hey kid, you got moxie." And then they bring you in on Friday night, or how did that work?
I don't know about Bravadi's, but I mean, that's not completely off. I mean, what happens now, there's an interesting, the way the world sort of split in comedy in the late 90s was it added a bunch of comedy in places that shouldn't have comedy, like bookstores and comic book venues and game shops. It's just like anywhere you could put patios behind a coffee shop, whatever. And they called that alt comedy for a long time. But there's enough shows like that if you go to an open mic, and those are run by just like comics. So if you go to an open mic for a little while and you're funny, somebody would pull you aside and they wouldn't be like this. They'd be like, "I do a show over at this tire factory that's closed on Thursday nights. Do you want to do 5 minutes?" And then you'd do that and you'd get $5 in tips, but you'd meet other people who are kind of working. So there's like a semi-pro, there's like a minor league of weird shows. And then eventually, if you do that, someone's like, oh, you should email somebody at the club, and then you can like get in there and start working. And then that makes a little bit more money. And then, yeah.
Okay. And then do you spend like years at this, like working your office job?
Yes.
And then going 100%. At night, and that's like, that's your thing. Like you do it
yes.
full time.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I was living in Portland for a long time, and you know, like everyone there has something else that they're, even if like you have a real job, but you're still doing this on the side, right? That's like true. Everybody who's got a even good jobs is like, well, but I also sell handbags made out of Scrabble boards on my Etsy shop. Like everyone's got that. So it's just comics. You just, your thing is going to an open mic from 10 PM till 2 AM on Tuesdays.
That really hurt that you said the Scrabble thing, because my niece actually makes baby Grogu's out of this is a baby Grogu, tiny baby Yoda over here.
Oh, I and see
it's,
that. Yeah,
it's knitted. It's entirely.
I mean, that
crocheted.
Is adorable, and I'm hoping cute enough that the mouse is not going to come after her.
Yeah, it's available. It's also just vaguely like could be a gremlin from one of these. So it could be
right.
Yeah, it could be Disney. Yeah, it could be Universal Studios.
In order to not get sued, she has to call it like alien baby of extremely old age. Yeah, that's cute. I love a little knitted Grogu. But yeah, so you got your side hustle. You got your weird projects, your art stuff, and then that. And for me, that was comedy. And then eventually you like cobble together enough like weird road gigs, and you're making a little bit of money here and a little bit of there. And then they're like, you're like, at some point I'm traveling enough that it's annoying to have a job, and okay. You can kind of fade into doing it full time.
So the weird road gig stuff, this is a parallel. A lot of the folks that are listening to the podcast are techies, and yep. A lot of them like go to conferences, and you know, I speak at conferences. This sounds a lot like the same way. Like I did the local user group, and I talked to like 30 guys in the back of a pizza place about Windows 95.
Yeah.
And then somebody said, we're doing a thing at the community college on the weekend. And then that turned into a weird road gig where I literally drove to Boise to a college to talk to 40 people.
Yeah, the Boise college gig. That's a classic. Man, I mean, and presumably a lot of those you'd like break even or lose money on when you're first starting. And then eventually they're like, we'll throw in enough that you can pay for your own plane ticket.
The best. So I would point out that international technical conference speaking is not as lucrative as mid-level comedy speaking. They were like, I will feed you and maybe we could get gas together. That was basically the
feeding is key. I knew a comic who used to have a card that said, like, I'm funnier if you feed me. So yeah. It's still a crucial part of the industry.
So is it struggling? We hear this idea of the struggling artist, and it's just constant suffering. Is comedy pain and suffering?
I come from such privilege. Like I was telling you, like I like sold an app and didn't have to work for a couple years. Like that's the most insane non-suffering story you'll ever hear in comedy. So I have to believe art can come from not suffering. Otherwise I have a peak, but I do, you know, I do hate, I mean, I, like, a, this is maybe too serious, but I genuinely hate this, like, the idea that you have to suffer to make stuff. Like, that's just, I mean, I know more people who have stopped making stuff because they're suffering than started. Like, I just think we've got a real bad confirmation bias on a lot of great artists were suffering, but it's like, oh, this came out of, you know, Beethoven was suffering or whatever. Yeah, everybody was suffering. There was no toilets yet. Like, everything sucked. And it was still mostly been forever rich people who have the time to write that write things. So it's not really suffering that makes great art. It just happens to be a thing that is easier to mine. If you are good at art, you can mine your suffering better than you can mine your success. But I don't like the fetishizing of suffering.
I think that's a totally reasonable thing to say. I mean, it's totally valid. Like I'm kind of in the middle of the bell curve, middle left of the bell curve when it comes to like suffering, you know, like, you know, I mean, I'm not trying to play the oppression Olympics here, but it's like, you know,
no, certainly it's not fun, but calling it a bell curve is already hilarious.
Yeah. That was, again, this is a programming show. So it's lower your expectations. No, but it's just like, you know, I'm okay. And I feel sad. Maybe I should be worse. You know what I mean? Like, how are you? I'm okay. Like the world sucks, but I'm fine. Like maybe I should be worse. And maybe my art would, or my code would somehow be better for that.
I mean, it's like, especially because of what the last couple of years have been like, I don't know if you heard, but it was weird. But there's a lot of people who are like, oh, I am like, this is my time. I need to I have all this free time. All of a sudden my job is not essential. I need to write a million. I got to write all my sitcom pilots now, whatever. But then also you're like, the world sucks. I need to take some care of myself and my mental health. And those two things fight inside all of the artists that I've known the last couple of years. And I tend to be more towards like, if you take care of yourself and get your life in order, you'll have time to sit down at your desk and be like, here's some yuck yucks.
Yeah, exactly. That's funny that you mentioned that, because everyone has been saying, like, you know, if you didn't learn Chinese during the pandemic, then you haven't really taken good choice. You're like, what are you even doing, right? You have nothing but time. That's horrible. That's hustle culture. Yeah. And hustle culture is toxic. It's totally bad.
I do think, I mean, I like to hustle, and I also, but that part of, yeah. And I did try to learn Korean, but I didn't learn Korean not out of not having the time, but out of not being very good at it. Very, very stupid. But it's a crazy time. It's the worst time to like say like you should be an artist. I mean, you should go on a walk, but like you should like become the thing you've always wanted to be. Like free time is different from like free time when the world is dying. It's not the same concept. Like free time is like everything is bad, so I have some time off is not the same as like, whoa, what a great vacation I'm going to take.
I just sold an app. Maybe I'll do comedy. That kind of free time.
I should say that what I did with that money was go do improv for 2 years, which is probably the worst investment anyone's ever made in their future. It happens to have worked out, but I would not recommend anybody who gets a lump sum go like hang out in Chicago and learn improv from the people who wrote books.
Oh, man, it sounds so awesome, though. Like that, I'm worried that by the time I have enough to quit and do that, I'm going to be too old to be funny. And then I'm just going to be like some Helen Mirren type old dude who's just like trying to tell jokes in like my 60s.
Is this an aspiration? Like you did this open mic back in the day and now you're doing public speaking. Is this like, want to do comedy?
Do you know that it's been on my bio, failed stand-up comic for the last 20 years? This is a real thing, Alex. I'm not joking.
That's a little harsh on yourself then.
Ryan Reynolds has my career. Back when I had hair, there was a show called Two Guys, a Girl, and a Pizza Place.
I remember.
And I could have been on that show. That was the show. Like, that was just perfect. I was just like, oh, that was great. You know, I'm not saying I'm as pretty as Ryan Reynolds, you know, but there's a certain symmetry there. And I had hair at the time, and it was an amazing time. And I was like, oh. And then as Ryan Reynolds rose, I went to work at Microsoft. And
wait, did you audition for this? Or you just thought you seemed like that guy, and so you should be on the show?
So two things. One, I felt like I seemed like that guy. Like, I resonated deeply with that personality type.
But you weren't sitting in a room and it was like six people who look like you and then Ron Reynolds is one of them and they picked him.
That would be an amazing story.
It would be solid. But you think emotionally you should have been there, not that you just narrowly missed out. They don't cast people based on who feels like they should be on this show. You usually have to like audition and go through this process.
I am coming to terms with the fact that the casting agents don't just call you and know that there's a man in Portland.
Exactly. Yeah. So this is why I'm saying you're being harsh on yourself for saying failed. I feel like you did not even begin to try.
True story, though. I haven't actually ever told anyone this publicly. But great. A week before my son was born, I was in New York auditioning for a show. And I was going to get a talk show on a network that you would have heard of. And it would have been like a regular on the show, like kind of a Daily Show type of thing. And then my son came early. So it was birth of my son or be on TV. So,
wow.
So I flew home, man. Now I'm totally happy about that. Like, he's awesome. But
yeah, I mean, you've never told this publicly, which is good. But I assume you tell him that every time he annoys you.
No, every time I just say I could have been on TV and then I just stare at him.
You have to live up to my potential TV career now.
No, but this is, you know, the whole Gwyneth Paltrow sliding doors kind of thing. You think about those moments when your life gets cut in half. Like, is there you that didn't sell the app and is just funny in the office?
Yeah. I mean, certainly that is a possibility. I have had basically like every stupid thing that I've done has turned out okay, to the extent that like I've learned only the wrong lessons at this point. I mean, it's really dangerous. And that's why I also feel weird when I hear comics say like they like do what you love for a living, which is like, it's just so insanely lucky for someone to be able to do that. And most people don't. And it's not because of a lack of hustle or something. It's because most jobs are not lovable and we need jobs. So like, it's just a place of like, in like the universe bumped into itself in the right way, or I took the right sliding door, whatever, that I've gotten to be here. And so I really do try to keep that in perspective whenever somebody says that I do what I love. It's like, yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to. That shouldn't have happened. You should have this career in talk shows and I shouldn't. I don't know, just dumb luck. I actually think this is one of the things that problem is that you are interviewing me because you think that I'm doing well. You don't interview the people who failed and have to have like real jobs and still figure out how to like enjoy their lives. And there's such a weird confirmation bias again with like the way we talk to celebrities that everybody says like, yeah, you just do what you believe in. It's like, because you're only interviewing the people that worked for. if you were interviewing the people who did what they believed in and then like still have to go get health insurance, it would be a very different set of be like, actually, maybe don't follow your passion when it leads to a large amount of student debt or whatever.
That's the totally valid point. Now, that said, and in my lowercase d defense, I have interviewed over 800 people on the show, and I do very much try to catch people that like talk about imposter syndrome. We've done talk shows on failure.
Good.
You know, I want to talk to like, you know, whoever runs the IT department at Little Debbie Snack Cakes. And they're just like,
good. Okay, good. Yeah. That's as long as you interview people who are failures. I push for people to do that more. I've pitched this show to like podcast networks and nobody has bit yet, but I do think there's an interesting show of interviewing exclusively failures. It's you'd have to figure out how to sell it to the interview guest so it doesn't feel bad, but just be like, tell me about the door that you didn't take. Like, just talk to people about the talk show that you gave up to go do. My parents are both like in journalism, and my mom actually, they were like in DC being journalists after school, and my mom got an offer to move to New York and work for CBS News, which was a huge, huge move for her. But she was pregnant with my sister at the time, and they were like, you get 6 days of maternity leave. And she was like, not good enough. And for years, I've like felt kind of bad about that. Like, this, we were the thing keeping my parents from living that dream. And then like only like a year ago, I was talking to her about it, and I told her how much that story affected me. And she was like, oh yeah, this was for CBS News Radio, and they closed like 6 months later and would have laid everybody off, and I would have been in New York with no money and a kid and no job. So like, I think that's the part of that story that we don't get to think about all the time is like, I don't know what your show would have been like, but maybe you would have hated it and it wouldn't have worked out. You wouldn't have had anything else going on. So I do think it's really interesting to talk to people who are like failures about letting dreams go. I don't know. I'd have to figure out how to sell it so no one feels like, hey, I got called from the failure show. But I think there's an interesting interview series there.
No, I think there totally is. I mean, and that's very valid. I mean, first there's the acknowledgement that I am what I'm supposed to be. We are where we're supposed to be. Whatever happened happened for a reason. There's that.
Yeah.
It's cool that you stay focused on like your privilege and you understand like that that's coming from. Like, you could just kind of like float above the rest and just say, "Yes, I'm doing amazing." You know, you go to the high school reunion and just tell people how you're killing it in LA.
Yeah. I mean, I also don't know anybody who is in comedy, at least, but probably any art form that feels like they're killing it at any time. I mean, like, everybody feels like you're just, it's such a fragile, bizarre industry. And there's always so many people to compare yourself to that you don't know where, like what their journey is secretly. And so I also don't feel like I'm successful at any moment. So when you said, when we first, like, when I answered the call, whatever, this is what you were like, you're living the dream. I was like, does that what it looks like on Instagram?
The background was that I was in the car. We put on Spotify, we put on comedy, and Spotify chose you, and I'm with my kids, and like, you got picked by the Spotify algorithm.
Oh, amazing. I didn't realize that.
And then I'm like, I know that guy. So then we look up the album, and then we listen to the album straight through in the car. And my kids are just laughing their tails off. And I'm like, yeah, you know, and I'm the cool dad now. Cause I'm like, yeah, you know, Alex was important. We hung out together.
We watched a rocket launch together.
We went on a trip. We went to NASA. We were on a bus singing camp songs and stuff. And my 16-year-old was like, you know, you should have him on the show. And I was like, I should. So I text you right away. And I'm like, you're amazing. You're living the dream. Let's talk about your show. And now we're here.
Yeah, I mean, that's so kind, and I appreciate your 16-year-old booking hustle. I like that as well. I feel like I'm very lucky to be here, and also I feel like a failure most days. I mean, you know, as much as I think we shouldn't be hard on ourselves, especially during the pandemic, I do feel like every 5 minutes I didn't write a sitcom, I'm like, oh, I should have been writing. So I'm still hard on myself that way, and I still don't think, I mean, I am living a dream, and I never know if it's the dream, you know? That sounds like it was a more meaningful phrase. I just came up with that, and I don't actually know what it means.
I thought, but it was going to end on a really like inspirational t-shirt type of level, and it kind of just petered out at the end there. You need someone to do a little punch-up work on that one.
Yeah, I'll the second effort of that will be much better.
I worry that if I were like, I'm imagining this parallel universe where I'm a comedian, that I'd be like walking down the street and like at the top of my game, and then I would kind of stop and go, oh, I'm out of jokes.
Yeah. So there are basically two different like main mental problems that comedians have, and I think a lot of other artists, but mostly for comedians. But the one is, or mental blocks, I should say, not problems, but mental blocks. One is people who think everything they do immediately is crap and they have to throw it away and work on something new. And I mostly hang out with people like that. A lot of my friends are like, oh, I wrote it, it's great. I can't do that. It's not me. The next thing will be better. And then the other kind of mental block is like everything I do, I think this is the last thing I'll ever do. I'll never do anything this good ever again. And that's the side that I'm on. So for me, I spend a lot more time being like, I need to reuse every little piece of this. I need to repurpose this into 10 other things because I'll never have another good idea. So I spend a lot of time trying to figure out like, how can I take this thing that was a joke, it was a stand-up joke, and I can make it into a TikTok, and then I can take that TikTok apart and write it into a script and try to submit that, and then I can take that apart and make it a podcast idea and try to submit that because I'll never have another idea ever again. And then another one inevitably shows up, and then I'm like, okay, this one's the last one. Got to work on this forever.
That is... You're like, what are they saying? Singing my life with his fingers or whatever. Like, that's exactly.
That's me. How you feel?
Oh, my goodness. Because I'll do these talks for Microsoft, like a keynote, and I have to like own it. So it's like, come up with a new concept, right? So a couple of years ago, right before the pandemic, or actually right at the beginning of the pandemic, we did an episode of the Microsoft Office, like The Office, but with Microsoft. Okay. So like shaky cam, and I'm Perfect. Michael Scott. Yep. And it wasn't that cringe. It was actually okay. It wasn't a parody. Mm-hmm. It was just me and a bunch of dorks, and we all went and we wrote code, and it was amazing. And I was like, now I'm like, that's the best thing I've ever done. I should just quit, just do a George Costanza, good night, everybody, and then just leave, because it's never anything going to be better than that thing that we did together.
The only thing I can say to help with that I found is that it is fun to make things with my friends. And that's the thing that I keep coming back to is like, I like making stuff with my friends. So when I make something, I'm like, that's the best thing I'll ever do. I'll never have any other ideas ever again. But if I get together a couple of people I like and we start hanging out and doing stuff, we'll make something else.
Okay, so here's the thing, though. And again, I feel really like this is like the exposed episode of the Hansel Minutes podcast.
Yeah, I didn't mean for this to be so deep on you. This is supposed to be about me. Thing.
We need to hang out more, actually. It's sad that you moved away. I have such imposter syndrome that it is only by putting my friends together in a room that things that are amazing happen. Yeah. So I love working with them. And you know, my work friends are just amazing. And like, if I'm at home and I'm freaking out, I'll call them, and then good things will happen. And it wasn't me. It wasn't me that made it awesome. It was the fact that I was also in the room, and then that thing happened.
I completely agree. I think that's the kind of stuff. It doesn't really work as much for stand-up. You have to do some fiddling to make it work in stand-up. But you know, I'm trying to work on some TV stuff, and that's like one of the reasons why everybody likes TV so much as a writer, is because it's a collaborative writing process. It's a room, it's people kicking around ideas, and that's when I feel the most comfortable. And if you surround yourself with the people who have that opposite mental block, the people who are like, ideas are easy, I'll always have a million ideas, but none of them are good enough, and then I can be part of being like, no, this is a great idea, let's keep working on this one, and we can yin-yang together. So like, most of my best creative partners are people who have like a million ideas, but never believe in them. And I believe in every idea forever.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. That's like, I'm going to like have trouble dealing with this later, because that's like my whole career. And it's, again, it's not stand up. It's just like stand up with PowerPoint. And
well, yeah, I mean, whatever, I think it works for almost anything else that you're doing. And I think a lot about the creative process as being about your subconscious and getting things to come out of your subconscious. And so one of the best ways to do that is to have somebody else say something and then you react before you have a chance to think about it. So being in a group causes you to become less self-conscious and let stuff bubble up and come out. Like when you're improvising with people, you say things you didn't realize you were trying to say. And so when I'm writing alone, the way I try to make my process, I try to build my process around accidentally saying something I wasn't expecting, where I'm surprised by what I wrote. And usually that's just like doing it fast. Like the faster I write, the more likely something is to pop out of my head. I love like, I'm gonna list 15 bad ideas for this joke. And if I write them fast enough, the ninth one will be kind of good. If I just give myself a bad task, a really low, like the quality doesn't matter, just a lot of things quickly, one of those things might be good because it came out on accident. But that's like trying to recreate the group dynamic by myself.
There's a thing in programming you probably know called rubber ducking, where you're alone in a room and you have a little rubber duck that sits on your desk and you have a problem and you're stuck and you just tell the rubber duck about the problem and then you simulate.
I've not heard this, but I love it.
You ever heard that? It's a real thing. It's like vibing. So like I'll talk to my wife about some problem at work and she will feign interest. Yep. And by halfway through the sentence, I'm like, oh, I just figured it out. And she's like, I'm glad I could help.
Yeah, absolutely. When you have to verbalize it. Yeah, that's awesome. I like also picturing the little rubber duck too.
At the end of the day, your customer has to be at the center of everything you do. This starts with the right customer data strategy, as well as the right foundation to solve the challenges that typically inhibit the success of your company, such as data quality, data governance, and connectivity. mParticle is your real-time customer data infrastructure that helps you accelerate your data strategy by cleansing, visualizing, and integrating your customer data from anywhere to anywhere. Ultimately, better data leads to better decisions, better customer experiences, and better outcomes. See why the best brands choose mParticle. Go to mParticle.com. That's mParticle.com.
How many times have you been vibing, said something, and then forgot to write it down? And then like you go back every couple of months and wince because you know it was the greatest joke that was ever written, but now you can't get it back.
I'll tell you the truth, it's been a while because now I am obsessive about writing things down. I am very good at every terrible thing. Like that's another thing, like I think about building your life structurally around being creative, is just like there is always a place to write something down in every room I'm in. I have my systems on my phone and on my computer to like get ideas quickly and make sure that they're there and I have something to work with. I mean, I still have times where I'm like, I have no idea what this cryptic message from my past meant. You know, I have a lot of notes, especially like on the side of like the place I put notes next to the bed, where I have a lot of things where I'm like, I have no idea. And every time I've ever written on that notebook, I've thought to myself, this is the one. The other times I write in the middle of the night, they're stupid, but this one makes the most sense of anything I've ever said. And then I wake up in the morning, it's like adopt an otter. And I have no idea what I meant by that. I have no idea what like, but at the time it seemed brilliant. But I do think a big thing about being a comedian versus a normal person, like I think muggles have dumb things come through their brains all the time. You think of stupid things all the time. And I don't have a higher rate of that. I am just like my brain is set up as a dream catcher. I write them down and you don't.
That is 100% true. So for people who made it this far into the show, comedian or not, writing stuff down is the superpower. That is the thing. Having Moleskine notebook within reach. Yeah. Boom, write it down.
Yeah, I love it. I love a notebook. I've got a little notebook in my pocket. I also love like I like one of my ways I procrastinate is reorganize my digital notes. So I really love getting everything in Notion and moving it around and reorganizing and tagging things and playing around in the notes. And I do sometimes come up with new things from that, but mostly it's procrastination. But I think even if you're not doing, if you have nothing coming up, you're not doing a speech anytime soon, but if you just like write down thoughts that are interesting to you, anything that is kind of funny, kind of deep feeling, then all of a sudden you're like, oh, I got to give a best man speech on Tuesday. And you just go through your notebook and flip it and you'll find something, some little puzzle piece. Like everything could be a puzzle piece that'll work later on something else.
I use Siri a lot and my notes are like, oh, quick, grab the note. And I talk to Siri. And the problem is I will get homonyms. I get words that sound the same. And then like my like, you know, idiot from the past is like, put Rain-X on the shower door. I don't know what that means, why it was funny. It could mean something else. It could have sounded like Siri heard that, but I don't know.
So then I assume that what you meant was you're tired of doing the squeegee naked when you're done in your glass shower. And so if you spray with Rain-X, it would just bead right off, right?
I hope so. I don't know if that's going to be chemically.
I don't know if that works, but I'm open to trying it.
Yeah, these are the questions that we ask. Yeah. But you're right. Somebody literally yesterday, I'm looking at my Twitter DMs right here, and this is a real thing that just happened. A person online said that they're headlining their first tech conference, and they're a little anxious, and 30 minutes is starting to sound like a long time. And I'm like, and they want to know if I had some help. So I'm gonna go and coach them. And I know you do the same kind of thing. If you go to alexfalcone.ninja, you can do punch-ups, professional speaking, improve your public speaking. You do all those things. You're like available.
Yeah, I'm mostly focused on comedy and writing, and I do. I definitely have some thoughts for this person.
Yeah, but like, so 30 minutes, there's no time at all. But I always say like 5 ideas times 6 minutes, boom, you just did a half an hour, right? You could chop it up however you want. It's much less than you think.
Yeah, the first time I ever did an hour, I got asked to do an hour of stand-up, and I was talking to an older stand-up, and I was like, I don't know, man, I feel like I got 40 minutes that are good, but I don't know if I can fill an hour. And he was like, talk slower, idiot. And that's pretty solid. If you talk slower, man,
that's
the time.
For a friend, talk slower, idiot.
Yeah, I think that's a solid bit of advice. I mean, also, the thing about 30 minutes sounding like a long time is that 30 minutes is a very long time or a very short time, depending on what's going on. I mean, they're like, mostly when you start doing stand-up, you get 3 minutes or 5 minutes. And like 5 minutes is a short time if you're a public speaker. If I told you you only had 5 minutes to get a point, like to do your whole speech, you'd be like, I'm barely getting going in five. But if I brought you to an open mic and you watched somebody who was terrible, that 5 minutes would feel like forever. There's like an old joke in comedy. It's like, if a doctor tells you you have 5 minutes to live, go to an open mic because they'll make it feel like eternity. So like 30 minutes is a long time, and it's also a short time depending on what you're doing. But the main, as long as you talk slower, you'll fill the time. If you're worried about filling it, geez. And also, well, like, just take some questions. Is that odd? I don't know how your conferences work, but take a Q&A. Yeah.
Long outro, Q&A, and there's like 5 minutes in the middle there.
Yeah. Yeah, if you add a Q&A, I mean, 30 minutes, yeah, you definitely. If you add a Q&A at the end, two questions, you can filibuster and get out of there.
I wonder sometimes, I'm seeing a lot of comedians on TikToks that like taking questions from the audience. It's like, did you run out of material, or are you just riffing off what that guy in the front row's wearing?
Well, so both of those things are probably true, especially if they're TikTok famous, where they're getting gigs before they can really do an hour of stand-up. And so they do need to riff and do Q&A to fill time. But the other thing is, a lot of people are still really like protective of their written material. And so they only post the riffing onto TikTok because they're like, you can't steal the riff. It's gone forever. Which I also don't understand the like being protective of your written stuff. Like if I tell a joke, my whole life is begging people to listen to this joke. You know, like the fact that you heard it on Sirius is, or on Spotify is amazing. But if you heard it on TikTok, just as amazing. I just want people to hear this thing I wrote. I can't pay people to come watch me do shows most of the time. And so if I put it on TikTok and a million people see it, I'm not like, oh, they all stole my essence. Like that's a million people who saw a joke. That's amazing.
So that's funny. So when I texted you to come on this show, I was like, what can I do to support you? And you're like,
yes,
tweet about my show, talk about my podcast. Like I'm going to your website here and I click on shows and it's like Pandora, Spotify, Apple Music, Amazon. Like your stuff is available, you know, free basically everywhere. I was like, I thought you wanted me to pay $11 for this.
Yeah. I mean, this is weird time to like say like, hey, go buy a record. I mean, if you really want to support me, what you should do is you should fire up one of the places that it's available. Pandora is great. Whatever. Fire up the record. Just put it on repeat. Turn the sound off. Walk out of the room. That would be just get me a lot of those sweet, sweet plays. But no, I don't. I mean, I don't know. I really do appreciate it. It's a very, very nice question of like, what's the best way to buy this to support you? But like, I don't know, we don't buy music and no one buys records. If I had a physical thing to sell you, I'd feel good about it. But if you listen to it and like it, that is amazing. In your case, you can tweet about it. But if your listeners are not famous, if they just listen to it, I'm not mad. I don't want you to do anything. Just have a good time, like the joke. And then if I did say, if I'm in town, come see me. But just also, you should come to hang out. You know, I just feel like because so many things have worked out when I have not been trying very hard, why would I be super pushy right now about trying to get an extra couple of dollars out of somebody? If you like me, this will work out in the long run. Let's just hang out.
Do you like look at your Spotify plays, like go to your wife who has a real job and insurance and you go like $8 today?
Well, this is my first record. So this is the first time I haven't actually gotten any of the reports yet from when that record came out. I do constantly tell her about TikTok numbers, which is really silly. And it's like trying to get her trying to explain to her like when this, like I have to be like, this is a good number. This is bad. This doesn't matter. And this does matter. It actually kind of like shows how artificial all of it is like I can just convince you this matters, and then I'll have a conversation with somebody, they'll see like, oh my god, this is available on this platform, you're so successful, and then I could be like, well, is it? I get $6 a month from this, who cares? But then I could be on TikTok and someone's like, oh, you got a bunch of views on this TikTok, now my kids all think you're famous. So it's whatever I can explain to somebody is important, they will believe me.
I've been goofing around on TikTok and someone was like, you know, the keyboard warriors are the worst. And someone was like, says the guy who has 100,000 followers. And I was like, I've made $8 this year on TikTok. Like, this is not like this is not even lead generation.
Yeah. TikTok is hilarious. Like where the numbers are so absurd that like, this happened to a lot of comedians over pandemic. This is one of the things I did over pandemic. I was like terrible at social media until about a year ago. And then I was like, I should probably figure this out because I've got a record coming out at the end of the year. And I had a meeting with the promotion people and they're like, we use all your social numbers to figure out and like some of the demo information to figure out who will like your record and advertise to them. I was like, well, I should probably get some followers so you have some information. I should get you some input. And so I decided to like actually learn social media stuff. And I really enjoy TikTok, but like the numbers are just so silly. Like I have videos that have 5 million views, when I was on Colbert last year, his numbers for a whole show is like 3 million. And so my fraction of that was probably much, much less. So more people saw this thing where I cut holes in books and put allergy medicine in it than the people have seen me do stand up on Colbert. And that felt like way more important at other days. So, I mean, that's why I'm like not stressed about any one particular metric, really. It's just like I'm just doing goofy things and people like it. And the fun thing about TikTok is it's like it feels like we're all playing an improv game together where people are like responding to funny comments and making new videos. And then people are making videos and shorts videos and we're just all like messing around.
I don't like the comments. I find a lot of them kind of mean, but I have found
that's TikTok so fascinating that you say that because I feel like TikTok are the nicest comments.
Really?
I have been so, yeah, I mean, like every YouTube comment, every Instagram comment is like, your eyebrows are bad or whatever, like your teeth are weird. And then TikTok, people are like some of the most fun, sweetest. Maybe I just got lucky on the group that followed me out of the gate, but it's like
interesting,
really, really kind there.
And like, I don't know. As with everything, it depends, right? Like it just depends on who you get. Like I've been writing, I've been doing all these programming things. So I did like an exquisitely detailed video on recursion and 5,000 people watch it and no one cares. And then a couple days ago, I post me cutting an apple at speed and it's like 20,000 people. And it's like 168 comments about, you know, did you wash the apple? Like, I don't know what to do with this information.
Well, that is bizarre. And that is also the TikTok story that the things you put less work, like you never know what is going to work. And so it's kind of, that's another part of the game. That's
tire,
fun.
What's the we got to go because we're running out of time here, but the tire story, you got scammed. Someone tried to rip you off.
I nearly scammed. I barely survived getting scammed. Yeah. I had a couple of like, just roving short con guys who like pulled me over and said my tire was about to fall off. My wheel was about to fall off. And then they claimed to fix it and then tried to charge me $250. Yeah. And that's like there's a story that happened. It's not even a joke yet. It's not stand up. It could be someday, but I was just like, TikTok likes longer videos right now. So I was like, I'm just going to sit down and tell this story about this crazy thing. But the best part of that story, if you watch the TikTok, is that I had this thing, I got out of it. They didn't murder me. They didn't get any money. Cause who has money? I definitely don't have $250 cash. But then after they left, I went home and I was like, wobbly wheel scam. Is this a real thing? I thought everyone knew about it, but me. And so I Google it and the guys who tried to rob me are the number one search result on Google. They're the guys who do all the, they are like celebrity. They are the most famous wobbly wheel scammers in the country. And that's great. So I could tell a story and then show you a little picture. These are the crazy guys and they don't look trustworthy. And everyone's like, you learned
that. That you learned that afterwards though.
Yeah.
If you had known that, like if you had known it the day before and then they did that to you and you were like, oh, dude, huge fan, loving this, the wobbly wheel scam, let's talk about it.
It would have been so bizarre if they pulled somebody over and they were like, oh my god, you're the guy from TikTok, because I've been showing everybody their pictures now. I do hope people are less likely to get scammed, but man, they are going to have somebody fan out on them, because it was a clever little scam they had.
That's so messed up.
One quick thing about TikTok before you go is it about the comments that I really, really enjoy, and I think this might make sense for your, not for Apple video, but some of your other videos, which is that when I do jokes, I like to write kind of I like to write little things that people aren't going to get in the moment, but like a couple of people will be like, oh yeah. And so that's my favorite kind of jokes, when they get kind of dense. And when I put them on TikTok, basically one of the things that kids do on TikTok is they just comment their favorite moment of the video. They just say the line from the video. Yeah, and then that gets more and more votes based on how many other people thought that was their favorite line. So when I tell the joke in person, people laugh or they don't laugh and then I move on. But on TikTok, I get to see all these people go, oh, that was my favorite. Oh, this was kind of subtle. Oh, you snuck this joke in there, and just get to see them all like appreciate each sentence individually. It's very kind. It's very supportive in a way.
That is very true. On the really viral ones, you'll see like the top five sentences in snippets, like five or six words quoted, and then they'll upvote them. And you'll have like 40,000 people.
I love that. I love that line. Yeah. It's amazing. Awesome. It's been really an interesting process as a comic, I think. I think TikTok's been the most interesting thing that's happened to me.
Well, most interesting thing that's happened to me is I listened to your album recently. See how I segued, how professional that was?
So yeah, it sounds like you're wrapping it up. More professional than you were at getting the tech started.
So I've done 800 episodes of this show, and I am a professional programmer who knows his things, and I get on the podcast here, and my camera doesn't work, and OBS won't work, and then I turn purple and green at some point.
Yeah, the palette you filter.
What's great is that I'm simultaneously trying to fix it and also convince Alex that I'm not an idiot.
Yes,
and he's not buying it. Like.
No, I know it so well from doing these podcasts and having people on and trying to figure out tech where I'll be like, yeah, I've done this the same way every week for 10 years and today it doesn't work and I don't know why and I have somebody who I want to impress waiting on me. So it's just so satisfying to be on the other end of that. And so I am laughing at you. No, just it's like, just look at how fun it is when it's not you.
Well, and then who do I blame, right? Bill Gates, right? I mean, he's the one who's been hiding all this tech from us for all these years.
Yeah, that was the nicest thing. You tweeted my Bill Gates joke to your Bill Gates people. That was really fun.
Yeah, anytime there's a Microsoft joke, the whole, like, we were listening in the car and my kids are like, oh, Bill Gates, like, you mentioned Bill Gates in that joke. You know, like, there was like a whole moment. So, yes.
I did that joke in Seattle a couple of weeks ago and I was like, oh, he might have been here. I probably shouldn't have said that. I might want a grant someday.
You're going to do that one time and he's going to end up being in the back
and
you're going to pick on Bill Gates and it's going to be a whole thing. You can only bring up Vista. If you bring up Windows Vista, it's a certain demographic. Some of the young people don't remember the times, the dark times.
Well, also, I was shocked in that joke because one of the versions of that joke, I makes fun of Clippy. And there are some very passionate Clippy stans out there. People come out of the woodwork to defend Clippy. People who are like in high school when Clippy was first out, they were like, Clippy got me through all these writing tests and stuff. Yep.
People look at Clippy as like the Bob Ross of Microsoft Office. You know,
the TikTok thing where they focus in on one little part was like people. I had no idea that that one line was resonating with people the way it was, and now I know that, so I can change how I deliver it.
And you really do that. Like you take that data and then you turn around and you're like, that worked. So I'm going to hit that word harder.
I'm going to hit that harder, and then people are not commenting on this other thing that I thought was brilliant. So I will change the order and I'll end on the better one, or I'll cut this line and get to the other thing faster.
That is one of the things people don't realize about public speaking. Comedy, technical speaking, whatever. Word order matters. Some words are funnier than others. Mm-hmm. Why is that word funnier? Because it feels funnier in my mouth.
Yep.
And I'll tell them that and they won't believe me. And I'll do the thing and they'll say, wow, you were right. That word feels funnier.
It's also funnier or more interesting because you like it. If you tell the thing, tell a story or a joke and it works really well, and then you get bored of telling it, it'll stop working. And you'd be like, I'm doing the same thing. Why did it stop? And it's because you're not in love with it anymore and people could just tell. There's so many subtle things you do that make a huge difference in the long run. When you're coaching this person on their 30 minutes, I mean, I don't want to like stress them out that all this stuff by making it sound harder and harder. It's actually just like, if you're having a good time with it, the story will actually work better. That's one of the main things. I learned this in one of my improv classes when I stopped working and started hanging out with improv people. But I had this improv teacher who was like, if you're having fun, it is impossible for people to watch you have fun and be mad. It's just, if you can't just sit in a crowd, arms crossed, be like, how dare they have such a good time? So if you are having fun giving your speech, the crowd will they'll be forced emotionally to be on your side.
Absolutely. And I also coach people to say that most times the crowd wants you to win. They don't they didn't come there and pay the money to see you fail. They want you to win. So they're going to
People say that about comedy that I was like, when I first started doing stand-up, that people are like rooting against you. And they're not. It's not like Blues Brothers where they're throwing bottles and stuff. There are bad gigs and there are some people in the audience that are bad, but 99% of the time people came because this is the only good thing they're doing this week. You know, this is their one night out. They got a babysitter. They bought dinner. This is like a $200 night for them. They do not want you to bomb. That's not helpful to them at all.
Very cool. Well, thank you so much, Alex Falcone, for hanging out with me today.
What a pleasure.
Yeah, man, this is great. You should probably do comedy or have a podcast or something because you're a charming, charming devil. You can check out Alex and his debut album, Vanilla, on everywhere that albums are sold or streamed, all the places. I heard it on Spotify. And then also check him out at the Read It and Weep podcast, where he and his friends talk about movies. And you've been doing that for five seasons now.
Yeah, well, five seasons. The first season was 350 episodes. We have kind of long. That was my favorite joke on that show, is after 350 episodes, we're like, now season two. But it's gotten buried by the other seasons. But the thing we're doing this season, if I can real quick pitch for the podcast, is that we're playing a year-long movie game. So we each picked a secret movie, not secret, but we picked a movie. And then each week, one of us, whoever's turn is, gets to pick the next movie you watch that has the same actor as the movie you just watched. And so we're moving sort of the Kevin Bacon system. We're moving through movies. And if you can direct it to the movie you picked at the beginning of the season, you get points. And then we reset and you pick a new movie. So it's like a 50-week-long show of us trying to figure out how to steer Kevin Bacon points and watch movies we want. And then there's like superpowers and stuff. It's really silly. But it's like we took the movie watching show and then added a bunch of tabletop game rules to it.
As well you should. That sounds awesome. All right. I'm going to include links to all of this, including Alex's TikTok, in the show notes. This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.